From the studios of Boise State Public Radio News, I'm Gemma Gaudette. This is Idaho Matters. It's Friday, which means it's time for our reporter roundtable. We will, of course, do our best to get you up to date on the news that made headlines this last week. A lot to get to. And today, our panel includes Ian Mac Stevenson with Idaho Statesman, Logan Finney with Idaho Reports, and Murphy Woodhouse, Mountain West News Bureau reporter with Boise State Public Radio News. And Melissa Davlin will be joining us a little bit later in the program as well. Hi, everybody. Happy Friday.
Happy Friday,
Gemma. Happy Friday.
So, Ian, let's start with you. Let's head to the State House, where many Republican lawmakers are trying to restrict what materials children can view at libraries. In fact, I believe, Ian, this is the fourth attempt this session. So what happened on Wednesday?
Yes. So by my count, this is the fourth effort so far this session to bring forward a bill on this matter. There have been independent bills in the House. There was a bill in the Senate. Then there was a combination bill with sponsors in the House and the Senate, all of which were slightly different. But essentially, the aim of this is to, restrict what sorts of books children can get access to in a library. These laws would tie the prohibitions on the types of books to the state's obscenity law. And say that, restrict those books from access. And I should say that librarians say that they already have policies in place that to curate their materials, and that they already don't allow really obscene materials to be accessed by children. But that combination bill in the Senate, it failed to pass by one vote. And so now a House lawmaker who brought one of the earlier bills and also was one of the sponsors of that bill, Representative Jared Crane from Nampa, he's now brought forward House Bill 710. This would essentially allow that if a parent, for instance, of a child at a library were to file a written complaint that a given book or movie or other material at a library in a children's section, if they think it's harmful to children, they can file a written notice with the library of that. And if the library fails to move it to an adult section in 30 days, then they could file a court action and seek damages for that against the library. And that bill passed the House after a pretty robust debate on Wednesday. So now it'll head to the Senate, and we'll see what happens there. Historically, these bills have passed the House, but sometimes get hung up in the Senate. So I think it'll be interesting to see whether it makes its way through that body, too.
And there's a kind of a deadline, right, Logan, in the sense that the legislature had originally, I believe, wanted to wrap up like on March 22nd, but they've pushed that to the 29th. So some things, I think, would, moving fast and furious.
Sure. The 22nd, next Friday, was the original date that leadership had set early in the year. The following week, the 29th, is looking maybe more realistic now. But they are getting a lot of work done. They're passing a lot of the budget bills, getting through administrative rules. A lot of those checkboxes that need finish before session ends are getting ticked off.
And so, Logan, you were on the reporter roundtable a while back. I believe sometime last month we talked about this. It kind of all gets lost in my brain sometimes. But you were talking about a bill that would require age verification for pornography sites. There's an update to this bill. Can you fill us in on that?
Yeah, like you referenced, I talked about the bill on this show. It blurs together for me, too, a couple weeks ago.
Right.
Now. But this bill, House Bill 498, has now passed both the House and the Senate, which means it's on the way to the governor's desk, where Governor Brad Little can sign it, veto it, or let it become law without his signature. I haven't heard any indication what he's thinking on this one, but it passed both chambers unanimously. This would require adult websites, pornographic websites, to verify the age of their users, with the explicit goal of making sure minors are not accessing inappropriate, harmful materials on the internet. It's kind of the flip side of the coin to this library debate we've been having this whole time. And it's even something we hear in committee during these library debates is, why are we worried about libraries when kids can access all this inappropriate material on their phones anyway? So this would require websites with this kind of content to use some sort of third-party age verification tool. There are a number of different companies that are providing these tools now, or some sort of system where you basically like scan the back of your driver's license to prove that you're over age 18 when you're accessing these type of sites. Idaho is joining a very long list now of states who are passing laws like this. We're joining the ranks of Montana, Utah, Texas, Arkansas, Mississippi, North Carolina, Virginia. I believe Louisiana was the first one. So we're kind of getting in line with a lot of these states who are requiring these websites to check for ages of users at the website level.
So, Logan, what could potentially happen, with this in regards to that age verification? Because I think that you had said something in some of our notes back and forth about what Pornhub has done. Is it in the state of Montana?
So Pornhub is kind of the most commonly known one, but it's part of a network of these pornographic sites that are owned by the same parent company, and their parent company is protesting these types of laws very strongly. They've been in court with the state of Texas for a while now over Texas's age verification law. And a circuit court in the southern part of the country just allowed that law to actually take effect a couple of weeks ago now. And so as Pornhub and its parent company are advocating for a different method of age verification, they're just straight up blocking access for all users in these states. So in Utah, in Montana, in North Carolina, if you try and go to these websites, you don't even have the option to do age verification. You just get put a message basically pops up saying your state lawmakers have put in place this age verification law that we think is a bad idea, so you should contact them and tell them to do it a different way.
Oh, okay. So, what happens with this bill now? Does it go to the governor's desk?
Yeah, it's on the way to the governor's desk. Of course, there's kind of the traditional paperwork shuffle back and forth that has to happen as different people get different pieces of paperwork signed, so it may take a couple days to get there. But yes, it is on its way to the governor's desk, and we'll have an eye out to see if that gets signed.
Okay. So Murphy, let me bring you into the conversation and let's move away from the State House for a little bit, because we want to talk about some issues and things going on with the fire industry. And before we get into updated figures on the National Fire Registry, could you just remind us what that is?
Yeah, so the National Firefighter Registry for Cancer was mandated by Congress in 2018, and the online portal for it went live in April. So it's been up and running for nearly a year now. And in my reporting, I've certainly focused on wildland firefighter participation, but it is intended for firefighters of all stripes, retired, structure, volunteer, etc. And if things go according to plan, it could become the largest effort to date to better understand the relationship between firefighting and cancer, with an eye, of course, towards trying to reduce those risks. But it's certainly not the first effort along these lines, and the research that already has been done has provided some frankly disturbing findings. So researchers have found elevated risk of several cancers among firefighters, and the WHO, the World Health Organization, even classified the profession, like the whole profession, as a carcinogen in 2022. Less is known about wildland firefighters, but what is known paints a pretty dark picture as well. They have found elevated risk of lung cancer and risk that increases with years in the service, as well as cardiovascular disease and a number of other ailments. So yeah, given what we know now and the hoped for scale of the National Firefighter Registry, I think that there are reasons to suspect that what we ultimately learn, could be quite disturbing.
Okay, so the registry has been up and running for about a year, Murphy, and I know that you recently spoke with the person who's running it. So, what did you learn about where things stand right now?
Yeah, so when I first reported on the registry nearly a year ago, I think the story came out in May. I had a very good, frank conversation with Kenny Fent. He's an industrial hygienist with the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health, or NIOSH. That's a part of the CDC. And he's been heading up the NFR since it got going. Nearly a year since it went live. He recently told me that they're now sitting at well over 10,000 firefighters in general, so structure, wildland, etc. And about 1,800 of that 10,000 have some wildland, at least some wildland fire experience in their careers. And so that is up from about 5,000 overall late May of last year and about 800 wildland folks. And so that's steady progress, but Fent conceded that they were a little optimistic perhaps about where they'd be now. And let's hear from him.
We've got a lot more work to do just to get the word out and explain why this is important.
So yeah, they're going to professional conferences and they're putting out materials about the NFR and thinking of other ways to kind of get to people where they are. And I think, you know, kind of within wildland fire, there are, I think, some unique challenges because, you know, as in my experience with it, I think a lot of people are kind of in for a couple of years and then on with their lives. But anyway, they recognize that they need to, to do more to get the word out. And so last year he told me that the goal was to get to 200,000 overall in several years. And this time around, he said the goal was 100,000 within several years. So in either case, quite a ways to go. But he did also kind of put while conceding that they would have liked to see more at this point, you know, he kind of put where they stand in perspective. And so the largest study done to date on the connection between firefighting and cancer involved 30,000 people. And he says that they're on a very good trajectory to surpass that.
So, Murphy, you actually registered yourself last year. I'm curious about why you did that. But also, did Fent say why it's important to keep getting those numbers up, as you just mentioned?
Yeah. So, I mean, as a former wildland firefighter, these are certainly worries that I have had. And the NFR struck me as a meaningful way to do something with those feelings. But of course, you know, my participation alone is basically meaningless. This is one of those things that only works at a collective level. And, you know, I signed up because I am concerned about my health, of course, but frankly, much more so about the health of all of my many thousands of sisters and brothers in fire. We did or are set to do this coming summer work that, you know, just in the day to day, right, is plenty dangerous, many fatalities on the line, many serious injuries just from like the immediate risks. But to make this work safer, we really do need a fuller sense of the risk that it poses. And as far as I can tell, this is probably the most promising effort afoot to start to answer those questions robustly. And so, you know, I would just say personally, you know, if any firefighters, structure, wildland, whatever, are listening right now, and I suspect they are because Boise is, of course, home to the National Interagency Fire Center and so many other fire resources, you know, I would encourage you to follow the example of the many thousands who have already signed up. You know, I do think that we're going to learn some uncomfortable things here, but these are answers that we need, and these are also answers that we together are in a position to help provide. But, you know, Fent also, the way he kind of put it to me is that you really can't improve upon something if you're not measuring something. And I couldn't agree more. And then he kind of made, you know, with wildland folks specifically, he was even more emphatic about the importance of their participation. So not only, you know, are they, you know, probably the least studied subpopulation of firefighters, the risks that they're facing are getting more serious. And here's what he said about why.
We're not talking about vegetation fires anymore. It is, you know, very commonly involves man-made materials. And once you have man-made materials that are involved, the mixture of contaminants that are produced is much more complex and much more hazardous. And what I would say to wildland firefighters is that, you know, you need to join the registry because you are having those kinds of exposures and we do not understand the health implications.
You know, think about everything that's in your home right now. All of it. Imagine all of it. Cleaning chemicals, vehicles, synthetic materials, on and on and on and on, being consumed, and the fire that would be giving off. And so, the smoke that would give off. Imagine breathing that. And that's what we're asking wildland firefighters to do more frequently and of course, without any sort of respiratory protection. So I think that if we're going to be sending firefighters, wildland and otherwise, into situations whose risks we don't fully understand, I think we certainly have an obligation to try to better understand them.
Well, I appreciate those updates, Murphy. Before we head to break, Melissa, you have joined us, and you want to maybe quickly fill us in as to why you were running a little behind schedule.
Hi, Gemma. Thanks for letting me join late. We we were putting together our own show, Idaho Reports, airs Friday nights at 8 p.m. on public television. And I just got off set with Idaho Republican Party Chairwoman Dorothy Moon. We chatted about the caucus 2 weeks ago, some election bills that are currently making their way with various successes through the legislature. And more broadly speaking, you know, inclusion or adherence to the party platform and measures they're taking to make sure that legislators stick to those party platform planks and what that means for the party and voters as a whole. So we have that interview with Dorothy Moon that is airing tonight on Idaho Reports.
Okay. And what time can people catch that, Melissa?
8 p.m. in both Mountain Time and Pacific Time. And that will, and it's also available online after it airs at idahoptv.org.
So, Ian, there is a bill in the State House right now, House Bill 668, that would prohibit state employees from receiving gender-affirming care. But can you, first off, can you tell us about this? But then why are some critics saying that this could cost taxpayers millions of dollars?
Yeah, so this is a bill from the House that would restrict any public funds from being spent on any medical intervention, surgery, or other procedure that is gender-affirming healthcare for transgender people. And so this bill would definitely have sweeping effects. It mentions specifically, for instance, Medicaid, which is healthcare that low-income Idahoans receive, would not be able to reimburse for these kinds of treatments that transgender Idahoans receive. And, you know, I think it would very likely have sweeping effects on state employees as well. But there's some details there that I haven't been able to nail down yet. But, you know, state employees, they get health insurance generally through the state. And if no public funds, if no state funds can be spent on that health insurance, then there's a really big question about whether state employees could continue to receive gender-affirming healthcare if they're transgender at all under that health insurance. I should say the sponsor of the bill, Representative Julianne Young of Blackfoot, I asked her about this and she said she doesn't know what the effects of the bill would be on state employees and people on state health insurance. And I've tried to get answers from the state and so far haven't been able to, but I think it's fair to say it would definitely affect them. And the ACLU of Idaho actually, in a statement yesterday, they said that this law is likely the most restrictive in the state, in the country, excuse me, related to restricting public funds for gender-affirming care. And, you know, you asked about the costs of this, and this is something that came up in a Senate hearing yesterday, because this bill has already passed the House and now it's in the Senate. There was testimony from a number of transgender Idahoans, some of whom said that, you know, the gender-affirming care that they've received has saved their life, that they were having severe mental health issues previously, and that they were suicidal in some instances, and that the healthcare they've received has, you know, totally changed their life. And there was also testimony from an attorney and also a Democratic member of the Senate also said this, that there are concerns that this violates federal law and actually might have constitutional issues as well. So I think legal concerns there are that this attorney said that the federal Medicaid law doesn't allow discrimination on the basis of condition or type of diagnosis that a person has. And if you look carefully at the language of this bill, it restricts procedures that would alter the appearance of a person in, quote, a way that is inconsistent with the individual's biological sex, end quote. So some testifiers have brought up examples of, for instance, a woman who suffered from cancer and then elects to get breast reconstructive surgery, something like that, a woman who biologically, that would be considered that would not be under the purview of this law, that someone could still get healthcare coverage from that because it is not inconsistent with the individual's biological sex, whereas gender affirming care for a transgender person would not be covered. And so there's concerns that that might violate the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment and could. So very likely, if this, I think, bill passes, it'll be challenged in court. And we'd have to see what would happen with that if it gets challenged.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks for that update. Melissa, another bill I want to talk about is the Maternal Mortality Review Panel. But before you update us on where this bill is, can you just remind listeners what actually happened? And I believe this was this last legislative session or the session before where the panel was basically dissolved?
Right. When the original bill passed, it was for 5 years and it had what's called a sunset clause, which means after 5 years, in this case, the law that allows this committee to operate expires, and the legislature is going to have to either re-up it or this committee won't exist anymore. Last year, the House Health and Welfare Committee declined to renew it over concerns about government growth, the role of government. The Department of Health and Welfare, meanwhile, continued to collect that data. What the legislation allowed was for this committee to exist and have access to that data and collate it and analyze it. And so what happened now is that the Maternal Mortality Review Panel, this legislation would recreate it. It would put it underneath the Board of Medicine instead and use existing funds instead of using federal dollars. That was another concern. We don't want to, you know, take unnecessary federal money to make this happen. Mm-hmm. And so we would have been the only state once again without a maternal mortality review panel, a panel that basically looks at deaths of pregnant women and women who have given birth within the last year. And this would establish it. It was sponsored by Representative Megan Blanksma, Republican from Hammett. And it looks like it is headed to the governor's desk for either his signature or veto at this point.
Okay. Logan, before we go to break, the Senate advanced a bill to make emergency medical services an essential service. Now, I have a feeling a lot of folks don't realize that EMS has not gotten this funding before. So can you update us on this and really what this means?
Sure. First, I want to give my colleague at Idaho Reports, Ruth Brown, a big shout out. She has done such a good job for us covering these EMS developments over the last couple of years. Yeah, EMS, emergency medical services, are not classified as a essential service in Idaho, meaning the state is not required to fund it, and meaning that if you're out in the backcountry somewhere, you're not necessarily guaranteed to get an ambulance to you in a we'll say a reasonable amount of time. This is something that the state government has been looking at for a couple of years now. The legislature, of course, it really is a fan of local control. So they want to make sure that if the state is going to be putting in some support for the EMS system, they don't want it to be something where, you know, an office worker in Boise is determining EMS policy for the entire state. They really want to make sure that local emergency services stay local. So this piece of legislation that Ruth wrote about, Senate Bill 1416, it would move the existing EMS Bureau out from the Department of Health and Welfare, and it would put it under the Office of Emergency Management, which is a different section of the executive branch of the state government. There wouldn't be any funding for the upcoming fiscal year. It would just be setting this up. And the expectation would be that the state, if this bill goes through and this office is moved over to emergency management instead of health and welfare, it's expected that in fiscal year 26, the state would start doing some cost sharing to help make sure that these EMS services can stay sustainable at a local level.
Okay, I appreciate that update. So, Melissa, some friction with the Supreme Court and legislators right now. There's a bill at the State House that would basically, tie judicial pay with some other policy bills?
One in particular, and this is work that, again, producer Ruth Brown has been doing. And disclosure, my husband works with the courts, and so she's been covering this. But I can report on what she has tonight. She has an interview with Chief Justice Richard Bevin at the Idaho Supreme Court, talking about their concerns for a bill that was killed in the Senate on the Senate side last week that had to do with how judicial vacancies are filled if a judge retires in the middle of a term. The bill would make it so that substitute judges would fill in until the next election cycle. This new bill on the House side resurrects that, but it also puts pay raises for judicial staff or the judiciary in mm-hmm. that legislation. So in order for the judges to get pay raises, in other words, they have to take it with this policy bill too. Their Chief Justice Bevin expressed some concerns with that. Ruth has a great interview with him that airs tonight on Idaho Reports, and we'll also have the full transcript of that on idahoreports.org.
And we should note, Melissa, that these are for district judges, because when we talk about election cycle, it is district judges who are up for election, I would assume. Or does it go to magistrate judges who have what's called a retention election?
That is a great question. And Ruth has that reporting.
Okay, perfect.
I can jump in for a second there, Gemma.
Oh, yeah. Great, Logan.
Yeah, I definitely encourage people to tune in for this episode. The Idaho Constitution requires that judges in our state be elected, but it's a circumstance where if someone is on the court and they retire, the state law currently, there's a big process for appointing a replacement until the next election can be held. Some powerful lawmakers at the state house kind of take issue with some of the details in that process, and so they've been trying to adjust it a couple times over the last few years. The way that this is tied into policy and pay is interesting because, unlike other state agencies with what's called a change in employee compensation, so if you work for the Department of Environmental Quality or the Department of Agriculture or disclosure, even those of us at Idaho Public Television, we get a percentage amount assigned to the agency for raises each year. For judges, on the other hand, it's an amount that's set in statute. So it says this is what the salary is for the Supreme Court judges, and then it's kind of a ladder down for all the judges, justices there. This is shaping up. It may be a repeat of two legislative sessions ago where the lawmakers did something similar, tying the raises for judges to a policy provision. And Governor Brad Little ended up vetoing that policy provision, and the judges were the only state employees 2 years ago who did not receive raises. So the court has expressed some concern that it looks like they may be doing that again, and if there's an issue with the policy, the judges might not get a pay raise again.
Mm-hmm. And in full disclosure, I should also note that my husband works for the courts as well. Very quickly, Ian, can you get us up to date on some pressure, I guess more pressure, frankly, that's being put on the University of Idaho and the University of Phoenix deal? And this is coming from the Attorney General's office, correct?
Yeah, so it's become a pretty high profile duel between attorneys about this planned purchase by the University of Idaho of the University of Phoenix, which is an online university. It's a planned $550 million deal. That lawmakers have been concerned was not done in a legal manner because the university and the State Board of Education created a nonprofit entity to actually do the purchase. And an attorney for the legislature a few weeks ago determined that she doesn't think that that was within the scope of the authority of the State Board and the University of Idaho to do that. And now the Attorney General, Raul Labrador, has agreed with her, that attorney, as well as an outside law firm that they hired. On the other side, the University of Idaho and lawyers that they're working with, as well as their own attorney, have argued that they did have the authority and that they are a constitutional entity, and so therefore have a lot of authority that comes with that. And so, yeah, it's become a pretty high-profile dispute here, and mm-hmm. I'll add that there's a resolution going through the House, or sorry, going through the legislature at the moment that would allow lawmakers to file court action over this. Attorney General Raul Labrador has also said that he thinks he could intervene, And we're sort of 2 months away. We're barreling towards the deadline for this purchase, and the University of Idaho has to issue around $685 million in bonding before then. And so definitely a lot more to come on this story.
Okay, thanks for that update. And Murphy, you recently reported on a study of farm workers here in Idaho. Can you give us the basics?
Yeah, so I mean, it may be obvious, but I think it's worth saying that farm workers and many of those whose professions require them to do hard labor outside are very much on the front lines of climate change and the higher temperatures and smokier summers that it's bringing. So yeah, so last summer, researchers spoke with 16 farm workers in South Central Idaho to get a sense of how they see climate change impacting their health as they work long, hard hours in the open and, of course, work that feeds us. They wanted to learn about those impacts and the measures farm workers are taking to try and protect themselves. And perhaps more importantly, they also explored policy changes that could more effectively protect them.
So what were some of the key findings, Murphy?
I mean, I think kind of in general that it is very hard out there and certainly getting harder. Many do things like wear bandanas or maybe even face masks for the smoke, but you know that's likely not a very effective protection method. And I spoke with the lead author, Carly Hyland. She's a public health professor at Berkeley, and actually interesting previously at BSU. She made the point that the impacts of the intense working conditions endured by farm workers are only exacerbated by the precarious living conditions endured by many farm workers, such as, you know, lack of safe housing, lack of air conditioning, compromised access to healthcare, as well as the effects of anti-Latino racism and fear of law enforcement and deportation. So drinking lots of water is obviously a very effective way to stave off the effects of heat. But she said that she was very disturbed to learn that the bathrooms that many workers have access to are so dirty or remote that they sometimes moderate water intake to avoid having to go. And as Hyland put it to me, you can't just tell people to drink more water if they don't have access to safe and clean bathrooms.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. So Murphy, with climate change promising, I mean, only hotter and smokier summers, right? What are some of the policy suggestions then that the paper, or its authors are making?
Yeah, kind of like the 30,000 foot idea is captured by the following line from the paper. Quote, these findings emphasize the importance of shifting the burden of climate resiliency from individual farm workers to systemic workplace, residential, and community interventions. There are currently no national regulations for heat and outdoor work, though there are several states that have them, California, Oregon, and Washington. Idaho is not one of them, despite the fact that there is a very large farm worker population here. Hyland says that those sorts of regulations can be helpful, but can really only be meaningful if enforcement is adequate. She also suggested a couple other interesting ideas, more and longer breaks for water and cooling off. And she pointed to research in Nicaragua, that shows that not only can that make work safer, it can actually improve productivity. She also suggested hazard pay to acknowledge the risks endured by farm workers when they're toiling in triple digits and smoking conditions. I used to get hazard pay for fire, and certainly some of the hazards were that we were being compensated for overlap with the many risks that farm workers face. And another idea of hers that I found interesting was the idea of disaster pay, literally paying workers to not work on days when it simply can't be done safely. So many of these workers can't afford a day without pay, and this would be a way to acknowledge that.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate everyone's reporting, and thank you for making time for us today. We've been talking with Ian Max Stevenson with the Idaho Statesman, Logan Finney and Melissa Davlin with Idaho Reports, and our own Murphy Woodhouse, Mountain West News Bureau with Boise State Public Radio News. I would encourage all of you to read or listen to their reporting, and remember, Idaho Reports is on Idaho Public Television tonight, 8 p.m., both in Mountain and Pacific time. Thanks so much for listening to Idaho Matters. Boise State Public Radio and Idaho Matters are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters. You can find more shows in the network wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gemma Gaudet. We'll see you tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.